next speaker is Rick Kenyon from Brown, who's going to talk about discrete analytic functions of the integer.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I'm kind of nervous to talk in front of such a distinguished bunch of distinguished audience. I sort of fell on the avoided the hyperbolic geometry part of Bill Thurston education, but I did the dynamical system side. And I want to talk about some things which may be less known, but were inspired, and things I learned from Bill. One of which is, in the field of dynamical systems, there was some circle patterns, which hopefully I'll get time to show you at the end. There's also some domino tilings. He did some interesting. Sort of group theory of domino tilings, which is a very small project, but that was very useful for us in understanding some structure in some statistical mechanical models related to that, and also some rewriting rules. So for planar structures, we have a big planar structure, and you do some local manipulations, and you try to understand the space of configurations you can get to by local transformations. And underlying all these ideas, is some, in the background, there's some statistical mechanics and some probability models, which I probably won't have time to talk much about, but I wanted to just focus on a few simple dynamical systems, which are fairly general. By the way, I should mention, as you can see on the slide, this is based on joint work with several people, but primarily Scott Sheffield, who's at MIT, and Sasha Goncharov, who's at Yale, in different projects. So let's just jump in then. There is a theorem. I'm not sure actually how to pronounce Menelaus. Maybe somebody knows. And one version of that theorem involves, it's a very simple, Euclidean geometry result. You have two, in this case, the way I present it is two triangles which share an edge, have a common line segment like that. And they're not supposed to be right isosceles triangles, I just drew them that way, okay? And if you call ABCD I'm going to get too close there. A, B, C, D are the lengths of the edges on the left. You can think of erasing the. Is there a pointer? Erasing the common segment and drawing it in the other direction, and then you get four new lengths, E, F, G, H, and then you can make this combination of. Sort of bi ratio of lengths A, B, C, D. Thanks. Here. If I start here and go around this vertex counterclockwise, I get D divided by B times A divided by C. So that's this quantity. And if I do the same here, except this way, on this one I go clockwise. H divided by F times E divided by G. Okay? That's some version of Menelaus theorem. It's a simple Euclidean geometry. And so I want to make a dynamical system based on this very simple thing. And it starts out, it's a dynamical system on a torus. All right, but I unrolled it so that you can see the periodic structure on the plane. And I'm just going to start with two rectangles, although this is a special case of a much more general result, which hopefully I will try to explain how general it is a little bit later, but let's just take two rectangles, or if you like, you can just take two quadrilaterals, or in fact, any number of quadrilaterals on a torus, but they should have this particular combinatorial structure that these two share a boundary, and these, the the combinatorial structure is as indicated in the figure. And so now, let's draw in some diagonals, right? And there's this sort of zigzag path of diagonals here, where I take one of the diagonals of the big rectangle, and then I take the one in the other direction so that it makes a path, a zigzag path, right? And now, you can see in this figure, there is a little triangle, and I think of this as a Menelaus triangle, and I can erase that common segment and put in the other one. And by the, there's another one down here. In fact, the whole these triangles sort of tile the plane, and I'm going to do that little Menelaus switch on each of those triangles. And what happens is that this if you like, this diagonal sort of gets extended, and I get a new pair of rectangles, and I can erase the original ones, and that's one step of the dynamics. Okay, it's reasonably simple thing. So here's a little movie I made. We can watch a few iterations. So what's happening? That's the question. I'll stop. By the way, feel free to interrupt. I know that there's a bunch of, you know, experts on various things in the audience, and Yair handled it pretty well, and I will do my best to live up to his cool. I was very impressed with the way he handled this. But you know, don't be shy about asking questions. So now let's start over, and I'm going to associate to one of these Euclidean structures some other stuff. In particular, let's consider the following. I'm going to build a network for each tile, rectangle tiling, quadrilateral tiling. Although eventually it's just going to be an arbitrary tiling with polygons, convex polygons. And so we just put in each tile, we're going to put a white dot. And on each, so that the tiles are not necessarily edge to edge. They don't meet edge to edge, but the common boundaries form these segments. And I'm going to put a black dot on each boundary segment. So you should think of this black dot represents this whole edge here. And now I just connect up the, each tile has, of course, a certain number of boundaries and boundary edges, in this case, four, because they're squares. And I make a graph, planar bipartite graph. It's got white dots and black dots, and white dots are only adjacent to black dots. And here, of course, there's a big rectangle, and if I drew this picture on the board, you might ask, if the aspect ratio of each rectangle is given, maybe it's a square, like illustrated, how do I figure out the aspect ratio of the big region here? How do I fit these squares together to make a nice tiling? And of course, there's a bunch of equations which you have to satisfy. There's sort of you can think of each square as having one variable associated to it, the size of that square. And for each edge here, there's some equation that, linear equation that the sizes have to satisfy. Of course, this size equals the sum of those two sizes, right? So the size of this square has to be the sum of the size of the two bottom squares. So you have a certain number of variables, certain number of equations, and if you do the Euler characteristic calculation, right, there's a white dot for each face. There's four vertices. So you should think of each black segment as an open black segment, so it doesn't contain its endpoints, and then you decompose this disk, which has Euler characteristic 1, into a bunch of open 2 cells, open 1 cells, and vertices. There's only 4 vertices, which because it's a rectangle, and you do the calculation, and it comes out that the number of white dots equals the number of black dots. Well, notice that I didn't put any black dots on the boundaries except for the bottom boundary. So there's a little detail with the boundary conditions, but I'm just going to choose one of the boundaries. You know, the thing is sitting on the table, okay? So that, and the table counts as a, okay. So now, one can ask, well, is there a unique solution? Or is there a solution, right? It's a linear system. We have a certain number of variables. The number of variables equals the number of equations, and so there's a matrix associated to it. And is the matrix non-singular? Well, any suggestions? Well, yes, it is non-singular. But so let me describe how to do this in general. So in general, so far you've only seen pictures of squares, tilings with squares. But in general, you can do this with arbitrary polygons, let's say convex polygons for simplicity. And right, there's a white dot in each polygon, and I'm going to put some weights on the edges. In this linear system, there's some coefficients, which, well, were not quite obvious from the previous slide, but there are coefficients, and the coefficients are the, well, you can think of the coefficients as just being the lengths of some prototype for each tile. Like, if this is an isosceles right triangle, then, you know, I could think of B being 1. I'm going to think of A, B, and C here as being complex numbers. So B is 1, C is I, and A is, you know, minus 1 minus I. So it has a length and a direction. But then the variable is telling me how to scale that tile. I have some, you know, canonical tile of that type, but then I have to decide what scale it is so that it fits into the tiling. So those are the complex edge weights. And maybe I'll tell you about, maybe that one is a little bit out of order. But so when we do that in our example, right, every tile happened to be a square in my running example here. So the weights are just going to be 1. So this edge weight is 1, which means that this in the equation corresponding to this black vertex, this tile contributes 1, and the tiles from below contribute minus 1. So that I want this length equal to the sum of those two lengths, right? So that's why I have to worry about these coefficients, which in this case they're just complex numbers: 1i minus 1 minus i. So that system of equations now becomes a matrix, right? It's an adjacency matrix for this bipartite graph, which has these complex weights, right? And well, this matrix comes up somewhere else. It's in fact called the Castellane matrix of that bipartite graph. And Castellane was a mathematical physicist, you know, working in the 60s, solving some completely different problem, which was counting the dimer covers, or if you like, domino tilings of regions. And what makes a matrix a Castellane matrix? Well, you have a planar bipartite graph. Bipartite just means that the vertices come in two colors, black and white, and the edges only go from black to white. So it's the adjacency matrix is a matrix whose rows index the black vertices and columns index the white vertices. And the condition for being a Castellane matrix is that on each face, the alternating product of the weights, when you go around that face, has a certain sign. In this case, the sign is minus 1 to the half the length of the face plus 1. Since it's a bipartite graph, every face has an even number of edges. And so if a face has degree 4, then you want the alternating product. What I mean, the alternating product is the first length divided by the second times the third divided by the fourth, and so on. So it has to be either negative real or positive real, depending on whether it has 0 mod 4 or 2 mod 4. So now I can go back to that picture. If I happen to put two tiles next to each other in this order, right, you see that the two tiles correspond to these two white vertices, and the two black edges here, this one and that one, are the two black vertices, and those make a little cycle in my planar graph. And there are four edge weights associated here. And those four edgeways correspond to the four links, the four complex vectors, A, B, C, and D here. So this edge is C because this tile is adjacent to this black segment with the complex vector C here. I hope that's clear. And the remarkable thing is that, you know, it's not so remarkable actually. If I look at the alternating product here, A divided by C times D divided by B, well, A and B are complex numbers, but they are going in the same direction. So they're, opposite directions, if you like. So the ratio of those two is a negative real number. And same thing for C and D, that they're going in the same direction. The ratio is a positive real number. So when I form this bi-ratio, AD over BC, I get a negative real number. And that's exactly the condition that Castellane required for his matrix.
Question?
Yes?
Picture where you had squares.
Yeah.
It looked like the white circles were in the center point of the square.
Yeah.
I don't know how crucial that was.
No, the graph is just a combinatorial graph. The geometry of where I put the vertices plays no role.
So these complex numbers don't determine exactly what point the white square is
in? No. The complex numbers here, like B, is supposed to be a complex number which represents the weight on the edge. I'm just building a matrix, a graph with edge weights, okay? So don't pay attention to where I put the white and black squares. It's just associated to this tile, there is a white vertex.
So this doesn't have to be the center point or any of that?
No.
Good.
Sorry, that wasn't clear. Right, you can see it again here. Here's a square, right? The product of these two edge weights is I times minus 1, which is minus I. That's the negative of the product of these two weights, which is I. Okay, so this happens to be a Castellane matrix, and what's the point of a Castellane matrix is that its determinant counts something. Right, here's the theorem. The determinant of this matrix, which by the way is the determinant of our linear system that we were trying to decide if it was singular or not. So the determinant is a sum over dimer covers of the bipartite graph. A dimer cover is just a collection of edges which has a property that that covers all the vertices in the sense that each vertex is the edge point is the endpoint of one edge in that cover. And each dimer cover has a weight which is the product of I should have put some absolute values, the edge weights, the absolute values of the edge weights. And here, let me show you a picture. Yeah, that's a dimer cover. Here's my graph, and the fact that this graph does have at least one dimer cover, in this case it has many dimer covers, that is a proof that the determinant is non-singular. Because this is supposed to be a positive number. It's a sum over dimer covers of some positive weights. And I forgot the absolute value signs there. Perfect matching, yes. Same thing as a perfect matching. And the proof idea is the idea is easy. The first line of the proof is that you expand the determinant as a sum over the symmetric group here. You get a signature of the permutation times this product of matrix elements, right? Remember that the matrix is indexed by its rows are black vertices and the columns are white vertices, and every time you have a dimer cover, you associate it to every black vertex a neighboring white vertex, so this weight is non-zero. So each non-zero term here corresponds to a dimer cover, and the whole difficulty in the proof, which is, you know, it takes a few lines, is to show that every non-zero term here has exactly the same sign. So it's not that the determinant is a positive number, but all these terms add up coherently. The sign of the matrix entries are arranged so that they cancel with the sign of the permutation, and every non-zero term adds up coherently. And, just to see why that's true, if I took these two edges, and I reversed them by instead of matching this white vertex with that black vertex, I matched across here and that one across there, then in the determinant, I would be transposing the two black things. So that's multiplying the permutation by a transpose, but that so the signature of that permutation changes, but that signature is offset by the change in sign. So it's a cute combinatorial trick, which works for any planar bipartite graph for counting the number of perfect matchings or the weighted sum of perfect matchings. Okay, what does this have to do with discrete analytic functions, which were in the title of the talk? Well,
yeah. You said in the past one formula, there should have been absent values on the weights. Is that right?
Yes, but that's not essential. It's, even without the absolute value signs, all the terms have the same modulus, I mean complex argument. So when you take the absolute value of everything, it still adds up coherently. But you know, we think of adding these complex signs just to make the proof work, and what we really care about is the sum of perfect matchings, each one contributing positively. But it just so happens that we can put the signs in and things still add up coherently. We just have a global sign in front. Oh, so what's a discrete analytic function? Well, let's just define if we have a bipartite planar graph and a Castellan matrix K associated to it. Right. Remember, a Castellan matrix is a matrix which has the property that, well, around each face there's some condition on the signs of the entries of the matrix. It's an adjacency matrix with some signs thrown in. And let's say the function on the black vertices is discrete analytic if it's in the kernel of K. And well, why? One way to see that this is sort of only half an explanation of why I made this definition, or one should make this definition. If our graph happens to be Z2, right, which is our favorite bipartite graph, we can put the edge weights, as we did in the square tiling model above, we put edge weights I minus 1 minus I and 1 according to the direction out of each white vertex. And then if F is a function on the black vertices here and you do K of it, well, you get the sum of the values. It's an adjacency matrix, so K is the sum of the values of F at the adjacent vertices, which are all these four black vertices here. And when you add them up with the signs, then you can factor out the I, and then you get F here minus F there plus I times this value minus that value, which is kind of like a discrete X derivative plus I times a discrete Y derivative. So this matrix, is a discrete version of the, D bar operator. So if you're in the kernel of K, it's like you're a discrete analytic function. Of course, I'm claiming that this is the correct notion of discrete analyticity in a more general setting, and I was just too lazy to make a very complicated graph, which was not the square grid, but you can imagine that there are such things. Sorry. Okay, so.
You said that there was two reasons. So it looks like it's homomorphic to this graph, but then there was another reason.
Okay, I'll think about what I meant and respond. And respond. Well, before we go back to our dynamical system, let me just tell you a very simple kind of fun consequence of this network business, right? So here I try to make a slightly more general example with some. So each tile is a convex polygon, and here's the theorem. A convex polygon P, the big shape, if it happens to be convex, you can tile it with rational polygons if and only if the polygon P, the big polygon P, is rational. What do I mean? Well, if each tile has a property that the edge length ratios are rational, like so, if I scale this thing large enough, all the, well, no, that's not what I mean. Yeah, if each polygon has rational edge length ratios, then so does the big shape here. Okay, which, you know, it's not necessarily so surprising, but follows directly from this theory. Just because you write down this matrix and you can show that this matrix is non-singular because it has, well, one way to show it is because it has there are perfect matchings of the associated graph. But I'm going to give you a different proof of this theorem. In fact, I know a bunch of different proofs, maybe like five. And you know, if this were a number theory conference, I could give you a proof. And if it was combinatorics, I could give you a combinatorial proof. And you know, it's fun to try to figure out why these proofs are the same, because the proofs, you know, they're all very different from each other. And I was thinking as I was preparing this talk that we should have some notion, I mean, maybe there is some logical notion of what it means to take two very different looking proofs and to show that they're the same, or to understand the procedure by which two proofs can be thought of as the same. Does anybody know what that's called? Any logicians in the audience? Anyway, it's a concept which I guess I discussed at one point with Etienne Gis, who's somewhere here. So interproof, let's call it an interproof, right? I've got five proofs here, and why don't we, instead of proving theorems, figure out why two different proofs of the same theorem are really the same. There should be a Greek name for that.
You should call it a syzygy.
Syzygy, yeah. Syzygy.
Relation to relation.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. Anyway, so here's a proof which, in fact, Dylan Thurston, this is a proof which I guess I have to attribute to Dylan, although maybe he didn't think about it in his terms when he okay, so any tiling of a convex polygon, by tiling I just mean a tiling with convex pieces of this type, right? So hopefully I don't have to make my definitions too precise here. If you have questions about my definitions, please go ahead and ask. Tiling of a convex polygon can be with convex pieces can be reduced to the trivial tiling using these Menelaus moves, as on my first slide, and diagonal moves. And a diagonal move is you take a convex piece and you add a diagonal or remove a diagonal. Okay, and so here's I'm not going to prove the theorem, but I'm going to just illustrate it in an example, right? So here's a tiling of a polygon. What I can do is take this convex piece and add the diagonal there, right? And now you see two triangles adjacent to each other with a common boundary. Boundary line, like here, and so I can do a Menelaus move in here, which is to put in the other, you know, extend this boundary and erase that one. And once I've done that, then this tile and that tile are, you know, their union is convex, so I can erase their common thing, you know, doing this move backwards, and then these two are convex, and I can erase that one, and then this one and that one are convex, and I can erase it. So everything gets erased at that point, and I'm back to a single tile. The trivial tiling is the tiling with one tile. Okay, so that, you know, it looks pretty easy, right? But I defy you to try this yourself. I mean, it's kind of fun to try this on a bigger example, and because, you know, it generically it's going to take you sort of quadratically many moves, and this. Not really obvious that this is true, but it is true. And you know, this is, by the way, a proof of the theorem of the previous slide, because all these operations are sort of rational operations. They preserve this notion of rational that I defined. A polygon is rational if the ratio of any two sides is rational. Oh yeah, let me draw a picture. Right, you have two triangles which share a boundary segment, and then you erase this one, when you put in that one. So this is an example of a local rewriting, right? I have this big tiling, I'm just doing some local transformation, and eventually I get, I simplify my thing down to something very, very, very easy. Okay, back to our dynamical system now. Right, remember how our dynamical system worked? We started with some set of rectangles on a torus, and we drew in some diagonals, and so on. Well, in the right coordinates, this is something which some of you may recognize. Let's see. Maybe I should. So if you remember, in slide number one, there was associated to this vertex, there was a biratio of four lengths. This was like A, B, C, D. And I took A over B, C over D. That's not exactly what I took, but essentially that. Each vertex in the tiling corresponds to a face in the bipartite graph. And so to each face, here's my bipartite, for this tiling here, the corresponding bipartite graph is just a square grid, or a big piece of the square grid. And each face here corresponds to a vertex there, and it has associated to it a biratio. In this case, A over B, C over D, okay? So think of the variables on the faces here as these biratios. And remember, when you do the Menelaus theorem, this biratio just gets inverted. So what I'm gonna do is take all the in this copy of Z2, I take all the odd squares, the Y, the V, the Q, the W, and I apply the Menelaus move to those faces, and those guys get inverted. And the other biratios get updated in some slightly more complicated way, but in a nonetheless reasonably simple. So Z, originally I had some biratio Z, the new biratio looks like this. Z prime is Z times this, some function of the boundary biratios. So it's kind of an interesting fact that everything is local. So dynamics, now I've turned this into this geometric dynamical system into some algebraic system where I just take a bunch of positive real numbers which represent some ratios in this thing, and it's a rational, in fact, it's not just a rational transformation, it's an involution, right? But this involution involved flipping, doing the Menelaus move on all the odd faces. But I can also do and I can follow it by the Menelaus move on all the even faces, and the composition, T even and T composed with T odd is a rational dynamical system on this, infinite dimensional space. And this is something which has been studied for a long time now in integral systems theory. It's called the Hirota bilinear difference equation. Well, it's some version of the Hirota bilinear difference equation, also called octahedron equation. And it takes a long time to explain all the beautiful properties that this equation has. It's related to Plucker equations and relations and determinants and so on. If we start with a more general graph here, as I illustrated in the previous pictures, where we have triangles or more complicated shapes, we get some multidimensional version of this octahedron equation, but they're all integrable in the nicest sense.
What is T odd? It's just an application of the Menelaus.
So what T odd is so remember I drew in all these diagonals, and then I had these triangles. I should go back to the picture. Let me go back. There it is. Right. So you drew in all the diagonals, and then you get these triangles, and then you do the Menelaus. If you do the Menelaus here on every triangle, that corresponds to doing the Maybe it wasn't obvious, but when I draw on these diagonals, there's two ways to do it. I can draw in this diagonal, and then this, and then, you know, this zigzag path of diagonals, or I could do it in the other way. I could go up here, and then across, and then up here, and then across. Right, so there's sort of two families of these things, and if I do this decomposition, and then do the Menelaus move, that's my dynamical system. That's the first involution.
That's tau odd.
That's tau odd. If I want to do tau even, I would start with the other set of diagonals. Is that okay? I put in all these diagonals, and then on each triangle here, I do the Menelaus move. And that's T odd.
So,
yeah.
But the dynamical system is you keep doing T odd all the time?
No. I do T odd, then T even, then T odd, then T even, then T odd, then T. Because each of the T's is an involution. Otherwise, I would come back, I would just bounce back to where I started. I'll have to wait. Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, look at that. You guys did not ask enough questions because I'm almost at the end. Here's a different, completely different dynamical system. Sorry. But it has many features in common with the previous one, except that I don't understand, okay, anything about it. But I can certainly draw pictures. So what I'm going to do is take a map from Z2. I'm going to draw Z2 and R2 so that all the faces are, circular? Concyclic, yes. So each unit square of Z2 has image which lies on a circle, as illustrated. Okay. Now, I'm going to do something to all the odd faces. This one, this one, this one. See, notice that here's this nice circle here. It's got it goes through these four points, but. I feel like I need to use my fingers. There are four other points associated to this face, which is the other intersection point of these two circles here intersect here where this circle goes through, but they also intersect there. And these two circles also intersect there, and there's a point over here and a point over there. Those four points happen to be concyclic. So what I can do is take this circle and just erase it and draw in a new circle here. Well, as long as I do the same thing here, this circle will move to a circle going through this point and this point and that point and that point, and right, and then this circle and that circle will still pass through the same point, which is now that point. So what I can do is update all the odd circles. The circles with the sum of coordinates, odd. This one, this one, this one, this one. And I get a new configuration. Right? Did that make sense? That's a theorem. Whose theorem is that? That's another one of these classic theorems of projective geometry. If you take five circles, which are concentric, then there's a sixth circle which goes through the other intersection points. I'll remember the name in a second. I should have written that down. Here's a little simulation of that dynamical system, if I can find it here. Oops. So first I do odd. You see how that circle changes. Then I do even, then I do odd, then I do even. And it hops around. The circles are a grid. There's Z2, and a circle is odd if the sum of the coordinates of its lower left corner is odd. So you just think about the black and white faces of a checkerboard. And it's odd if you're black, and it's even if you're white. So So again, each map is an involution. T odd is an involution, T even is an involution. If I compose these two, then I get some non-trivial integrable system. Well, it's known to be integrable, but I don't understand the algebraic structure like I do in the previous case. Yes? Yes?
So this is a different integrable system.
It's a different integrable system, yes. But in some sense, it has many features in common with the one I described. And, you know, as far as I know, it's actually secretly the same. Although, since it's nonlinear, I'm not going to state that as an actual conjecture. I think maybe it's actually different, but somehow very closely related. Yes, you're right. What does integrable mean? The space of parameters, if I start with some sort of periodic configuration, there's a finite dimensional space of parameters, and the orbits of this dynamical system lie on some tori, and they're just in the appropriate coordinates. It's just a translation on some tori. The space of parameters is foliated by these tori, and on each torus, it's just a translation. In the previous one, there's a symplectic structure, and in fact, there's a smooth Hamiltonian integral system underlying, which I don't have time to talk about, but this is a discrete Hamiltonian system. Yes?
In the case of squares that you started at the very beginning,
yeah.
Are you doing a rotation of circle?
Yes, that first one is just a rotation of some circle, often some parameter space. But I can certainly, I was slightly lazy to not make a bigger example, but you can take any tiling of, think of these rectangles. In fact, they don't even have to be rectangles, they can just be quadrilaterals. But they have to have the same combinatorial, we meet in the same combinatorial way, and then you do this. This move, and that will be integral, but some higher dimensional torus.
But if you start with just squares, you don't care
that's
about
rotation.
Rotations, not the whole figure.
Yes, everything is SL2R invariant. There's one parameter.
One number, which is the ratio.
Well, it's really two numbers, right? Which is the right? You can make one of them the unit square, and then you have sort of two numbers to determine the height and the width of this guy.
No, but I thought it was square.
No, they're not squares.
Oh, they're not squares.
Not necessarily squares. It's a two-dimensional system in that case, and it's a symplectic.
It seems that this circle pack keeps trying and ever so slightly failing to be a circle pack. Does something nice happen when you make it the circles actually tangent or two systems?
Yeah. When the circles become tangent, the system stops working. That is, the map fixes the circles. Right. If these two circles are tangent, then this point and this point are the same, and so that nothing moves. So somehow the right angled circle pattern is like a fixed point for this dynamical system.
Is it an attractor?
Is it what?
Is this process of track being attracted to that configuration?
No. It's an integral, which means it's a on some torus, which stays strictly away from the fixed point. Sorry?
It's volume preserved.
Yes. I'm finished now, so please.
Are there further questions?
Yeah. You mentioned discrete analytic functions. Can any of the theorems that we teach in complex variables?
Well, thank you for this question. That's a great question. I mentioned discrete analytic functions. Yes, I'm going to. So the question is, what does it have to do with discrete analytic functions? I mentioned discrete analytic functions, and then I didn't say what they had to do with anything. Right? That's. Why did I not? Well, the thing is that you can think of your tiling as defining a discrete analytic function, and then when you do the dynamics, the function is not changing, it's just how you discretize it that is changing. Right? So that's part of why we know it's integrable, is that somehow the coordinates of the discrete analytic function are not changing under the dynamics. Those give you the invariance of this Hamiltonian system, and the Hamiltonian system is sort of working orthogonal to that, to the parts we really usually care about, which is that, you know, we understand, you know, this is discrete complex analysis here, and the integral system is working in some other space which doesn't see any of the large scale structure of the discrete maps. Right? It's like there's two different geometries here. There's the geometry of the tiling, which, you know, you're in the audience, you see it from far away, and when I do the dynamical systems, you know, the local details are changing, but the large scale geometry is not changing. This is something which I don't really understand, but seems to be a feature of this class of models, is that the integral system is changing the discrete structure without changing the large scale geometry. And so it's like working in the background. So that's why I didn't say anything about the discrete analytic functions, even though I could. I mean, when we're dealing with probability and statistical mechanics, we care about that large scale structure, and therefore, you know, it took a long time to discover this integral structure, because it's irrelevant for the probabilistic models. I mean, I think that's kind of what you were asking.
No, I was asking, there are expectations when you use the word analytic function, like the product of analytic functions is analytic, some sort of Cauchy integral theorem, and
yes.
These things hold?
Yes. Not the product, but the Cauchy Riemann equations are some version of the Castelling theorem. I mean, this is some sort of discrete version of the Cauchy Riemann equations. And if you take a very large tiling, you will see that it behaves geometrically just like a complex analytic function. I mean, I can make some pictures with, you know, there's some version of the Riemann mapping theorem and so on. The integral structure is somehow changing what it means to be a discrete analytic function without changing the function itself. But yeah, that will be a subject for a different talk.
Is it at all useful to think of these circles as the boundaries of hyperbolic planes?
No. The reason I'm hesitating, because I know why you're asking this question, which is that there is some other place where hyperbolic geometry arises in these dimer models, but I don't think it's the same place. So, but you know, it's just because I don't understand. Maybe there is some connection.
So, is these analytic functions are they useful or are they just beautiful?
Oh yes, very useful. I mean, Castelling was interested in understanding the probability model of random perfect matchings of Z2, right? And that's called the dimer model in statistical mechanics. And you know, using this determinant formulation, you can compute lots of things, the free energy, the correlation length, and correlations and phase transitions, and so on. And if you want to prove that the scaling limit of the model, when the mesh size goes to zero, has some nice conformal invariant properties, which is what string theorists love about dimer model, that's all very useful. This integral stuff is fairly recent, and I think people have not really connected the two theories, like I say. So there's still some work to be done.
Do you get convergence of your analytic functions when it takes the analytic?
Yes.
Could you repeat the questions on their
answer? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So, what? Sorry, who are you?
Andre
was asking how the analytic functions are useful in other places, and I was trying to answer how they're useful in statistical mechanics. And John, what was your question?
Scaling limit.
Yeah, right. You guys are asking all about not everything the talk was not about, which is too bad. But you know, you can take a scaling limit by letting the, you know, take Z2 and let the mesh size go to zero, and then try to understand the convergence of the discrete analytic functions to continuous analytic functions. And that has been worked out, and it's a very beautiful theory. I don't mean to dissuade other questions. Please come.
Any further questions? So, if not, let's thank Rick again.